The following lecture is provided by Biblical Training. The speaker is Dr. Craig Blomberg. More information is available at www.biblicaltraining.org.
Oh, I guess we're about ready to talk about Luke 1, 1 to 4. Just a guess. If you were following what I was doing with the first 6 points, in many ways, they were responding to questions. Is the text reliable? Do we know who wrote it? Can we date it? Do we have any reason to think they wanted to preserve accurate history? Did they have the ability to do so? Does the end result in the text suggest that they were trying to do so? Those are our first 6 points, and they're responding, as it were, to questions that other people ask. I could do the same thing. I could create 6 questions that these last 6 points ask, but in a sense, that was more damage control. Now I want to move to more positive evidence, not just replying to critics. And I suppose if you wanted to create the question, it would be, are there good, positive reasons for thinking that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are reliable? Matthew, Mark never give us an explicit purpose statement. John does, chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. Says, these things are written that you may believe that Jesus the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you may have life in his name. But that doesn't answer the question of how a gospel writer went about producing his book. Luke is the writer who does that for us in a fair amount of detail. I think it went to sleep. Oh, there we go. Many, he starts out, right at the very outset of his scroll. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. What's Luke saying there? He's saying, I was aware that there were already in existence other written accounts of portions of Jesus' life and ministry. Mark is probably one of them. If something like Q existed, it's probably another. As ancient histories were written, they often evolved from smaller sources that grouped together information about a certain phase of someone's life and ministry, or a series of teachings, or in the case of Christ, a series of his miracles. There could have been other shorter sources that Luke was aware of. There could have been the beginnings of some distortions of what would later turn into some of the apocryphal or Gnostic Gospels. It's hard to know, but there are at least several. The word many doesn't have to mean thousands, but it usually means more than three. Written sources, and that has stimulated Luke to produce one as well. He also acknowledges that he is basing what he says on eyewitness information. Because he's a Gentile, we have no reason to suspect he was even in Israel during Jesus' earthly life. He didn't see Jesus directly, so he is basing what he says on eyewitness information, but also from those who were servants of the word, ministers of the word, some translations say. Probably not just a way of talking about local pastors and Christian leaders, but talking about those who were authorized, commissioned, acknowledged by local Christian communities as people who had learned the gospel tradition, who were reliable, who had good memories, who could articulate well, and therefore were faithful transmitters of the tradition. So that also inspires confidence. And then it's clear that Luke is putting his literary and authorial stamp on his product to write an orderly account. New American Standard says in chronological order, but that's over-translating, a word that just means some kind of order. And interestingly, Luke in chapters 9 to 18 is the longest stretch of any of the gospel texts where there are almost no references to where and when Jesus is doing all of the different things that it says he does and teaches. But it looks very much like Luke has grouped things together according to common themes and topics. So it may not always be in chronological order. In fact, it can't be when it's in a different order than one of the other gospels has. But it is in an order that made sense to Luke, so that Theophilus, and according to early church tradition, a church behind him somewhere in the Greek-speaking world, might know with greater assurance the certainty of the things you have been taught. The other thing that's fascinating about that opening paragraph of Luke is that in condensed form, it is extremely similar to much longer opening paragraphs in the first century Jewish historian Josephus, and in the pre-Christian Greek historians Herodotus, Thucydides, and Polybius. And those four men are often, not always, but often designated as among the very most reliable ancient historians of what they narrated in the ancient Mediterranean world. Luke, in other words, is designating, is indicating to his readers that he thinks he's writing sober history with a theological purpose, absolutely, and in what's hopefully a pleasing and effective literary style. Artistry and theology don't have to work against history. They can, but they don't have to. The key is not to impose on Luke or any of the biblical writers modern standards of history writing. What do you mean you tell stories about his birth, one incident at age 12, and you jump to when he's 30? What kind of biographer are you? An ancient one. That's what kind you are. This idea that every detail and stage and phase of a person's life, no matter how famous they became, was worthy of recalling is a very modern notion. It goes back a little over 200 years, and no more than that. You didn't learn much about the childhood of Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar or Augustus Caesar or Apollonius of Tyana or anybody else from the ancient world. You focused on the parts that were most significant from which you could learn something. The idea of history told just for the sake of recording events would have made no sense at all to people in antiquity. Record something that people can learn from. Otherwise, don't waste your time. Life is short. And it was a lot shorter back then. I sometimes wonder what Luke would think of some of our blogs or some of our Facebook posts. Detailed description of what we ate for a meal. and how successful our kids' potty training was that day. I mean, too much information. Well, I'm just thinking of my friends. You're probably much better. Okay, I know Mother wants to know, but does it have to be posted to the world for Mother to know? Let's move on. Point number 8 in invisible ink, if you don't see the numbers on your handout. The presence of the hard sayings of Jesus also supports the gospel's historicity. Like Luke 14:26. Jesus on the road, large crowds gathered. He began to teach them and said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple." How many disciples are there in the room? No, don't raise your hands. How many of you hate all your friends? No, don't raise your hand. Really? Hate? Well, in Hebrew and in Greek, hate and love sometimes didn't refer to emotions at all, but what you didn't choose versus what you chose, what you didn't prefer versus what you preferred. There's a somewhat similar saying by Matthew, in Matthew, by Jesus, when he is sending out the 12. It's a different context. But in Matthew 10, verse 37, Jesus says, "Anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves their son or daughter more than me is not worthy than me. Worthy of me." That's probably a good commentary on what Jesus meant in Luke 14. That's challenging enough. But why did Luke write it? The one Gentile writer of all things, in such a potentially misleading form, unless there were some constraints on what he and his community could say, could not say, word it this way, word it that way. It's so awkward that you would have expected, if the gospel writers had major freedom to leave stuff out or drastically reword it, that Luke would have done so. Or a very different kind of example from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount of Olives about the destruction of the temple and the coming of the end. Mark chapter 13. And there's a parallel in Matthew. And in verse 32, after describing all of these events, he says, "But about that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son," not even Jesus in the limitations that he voluntarily adopted in the incarnation, "but only the Father." When the Gospels were being written, people were exalting Christ more and more. Why include a statement that made it sound like Jesus was ignorant of something as important as his own return? We can explain it theologically. It doesn't have to be a problem, but it's awkward. Harold Camping never learned this verse. If you don't remember, he was predicting the end of the world repeatedly on specific days just a couple of years ago. There must be some constraints on the gospel writers, for them to leave in such awkward and potentially misleading, hard sayings. But then the ninth point is sort of the flip side. What doesn't appear in the Gospels that you might expect to appear, what some have called the missing sayings or the missing topics, like circumcision. I suspect there are few, if any, adult men in this room who have had the major dilemma that many Greek and Roman men in the first century had. Starting to be attracted to this Jewish faith, maybe then being attracted to a messianic form of Judaism, aka early Christianity, and learning of a debate that was going on in those circles. Do you have to become a Jew first in order to become a Christian? Do you have to accept the yoke of the law and do your best to obey the 613 commands? Well, some of them hardly ever come up. I have never been tempted to boil a kid in its mother's milk. That's a baby goat, by the way. But circumcision. There were people called God-fearers who were willing to do their best with 612. But in a world without anesthesia? No. No. Fortunately for those guys, Acts 15 describes a major council that took place in Jerusalem that hashed it all out and said you don't have to be circumcised to be saved or to be anything else. But why didn't they just quote what Jesus talked and taught about it? Why isn't there something in the Gospels that somebody made up and attributed to Jesus, like we're told by so many scholars, many of the sayings were invented later, maybe because Christians believed that's how the Lord was leading them and guiding them, maybe through the words of a Christian prophet. And if it was Jesus, it didn't matter whether it was Jesus on earth or Jesus in heaven. Jesus said it, we'll put it in the gospel someplace. If that's the model, where is Jesus teaching on circumcision? There's not a word about it in the gospels. Apparently somebody didn't feel free to make it up. There was a mention of speaking in tongues earlier. That threatened to blow the church at Corinth wide open in 1 Corinthians 12 and 14. And 1 Corinthians is the one letter of Paul where Paul frequently alludes to Jesus' teachings on various topics of debate. Nothing about prophecy, evaluating prophecy, tongues, interpreting tongues. Why not quote Jesus? He was authoritative. That would settle the matter. Apparently because nobody knew anything that Jesus had said about the topic. Wasn't an issue in Israel, and nobody felt free to just make something up. Well, back to the errors of the blog world. And not just the blog world. I had the privilege when my older daughter was a senior in high school to be invited to speak to a world religions class. She had observed that the teacher had actually brought in a Jew and a Muslim and a Buddhist and a Hindu when they did those units, and they were finishing up the unit on Christianity, which hadn't been terribly favorable or terribly unfavorable, and there didn't appear to be a Christian guest coming, and so she went and said, can I tell you about my dad? Would you invite him? And to the teacher's credit, she said, sure. And so I came in, and I didn't come in with a presentation. I just came in for about an hour and answered questions. It was a great time. And about two-thirds of the way into it, the teacher herself said, can I ask a question? Sure. So if Jesus of Nazareth was a historical figure and a significant one, why is it that there's only one historian in the ancient world who wasn't Christian who ever mentioned Jesus? And I prayed, and I thought, okay, Lord, we'll find out now how much freedom I have here. And as nicely and as gently as I could, I said, well, ma'am, actually, there's about a dozen testimonies to Jesus. Oh, really? I didn't know that. Phew, thanks. People with strange-sounding names like the one she knew about, Josephus, but also half a dozen references scattered about the encyclopedic-sized collection of Jewish traditions known as the Talmud. In Greek circles, a man by the name of Mara ben Serapion and another named Lucian of Samosata. And in Roman circles, who animated that to come in so slowly? Oh, I think I did. Phallus, Pliny, Tacitus, Suetonius. I know they're household names for you. And if you're interested in seeing it all laid out in glorious detail and analyzed and arguments for and against the reliability, there's a wonderful book by a Dutch Calvinist from Michigan by the name of Robert Van Voorst, Jesus Outside the New Testament. And you don't have to take my word for it. And it's also at the bottom of your little bibliography. But let's create a composite. Let's put all the testimony together by non-Christian writers from the earliest centuries following the life of Jesus. Here's what you get. Jesus most certainly existed. He was Jewish. He lived in the first third of the first century as we date it today. He was born out of wedlock. Some very interesting stories by those who didn't believe in the virgin birth. Usually somebody messing around with Mary. Roman soldier is one common tradition, but they acknowledge he was born out of wedlock. That's interesting. When he grew up, his ministry intersected with that of a man named John, who baptized people for the repentance, for the forgiveness of sins. He had a brother named James, who was martyred in 62 AD by a high priest named Albinus. To use Josephus's phrase, he worked wondrous feats. That's F-E-A-T-S, not what's below your chair. Oh, those are just feet, right? He gathered disciples. Five of them are mentioned by name, a couple of them sort of corrupted. He regularly came into conflict with the Jewish authorities over interpretations of the law. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate, which narrows the time frame to Pilate's reign from 26 to 36 AD. One tradition from the Talmud that appears to have gotten slightly garbled that he was hung, but then even Christians spoke of suspension from a cross as akin to hanging on a tree. On Passover Eve, he was a sorcerer who led Israel astray. Sounds like another reference to the tradition about miracles, just like even in the pages of the Gospels, we hear the charge that he casts out demons by the prince of demons. He was believed to be the Messiah. Josephus calls him the so-called Messiah. And he was believed to be seen raised from the dead by his followers after his death, who have continued to meet together, and their numbers have grown, and now they sing a hymn to Jesus and worship him as if he were a god. Pliny, late 2nd century. Well, you say, that's not nearly the amount of detail that we find in the four Gospels. True enough. But then nobody had a clue this was someone who would one day be the founder of the religion that claimed the greatest number of adherents of any religion in the world. A couple billion today, if we count everybody and don't try to evaluate who's real and who isn't. Nobody in the ancient world ever wrote biographies about people unless they were wealthy, government officials, kings, queens, and their court, military rulers and leaders, aristocracy. I guess that goes with being wealthy. Philosophers or religious teachers who were in institutionalized, sanctioned positions of authority. Jesus fit none of those categories. This is about as much, maybe even a little more, as you might have expected. There's some great websites, great if, kind of like Herod was great, influential. You can find lists of a dozen names of first century Jewish and Greek writers. And then the websites portray, if Jesus existed, why do none of these first century historians refer to him? Because none of them are historians. There's a geographer. There's a botanist. There's the philosopher Philo, who died in 50 in Alexandria, Egypt, probably before Christianity ever got there. And you go down one by one, and you go, either somebody is downright deceptive, or they're just copying from another source, and they haven't bothered to check to see if these people really are historians. No, I can't think of a reason a botanist would refer to Jesus, even though a generation ago he was popular among some flower children.
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church, and it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 28428, Spokane, Washington, 99228, USA.